Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. On this Friday, after the end of the Republican National Convention, we'll talk about the president's very, very lengthy, probably illegal speech last night. What an amazing moment when you see the president of the United States turning the White House into a political prop, one of those many norms that's been violated, and of course, so many people just shrug their shoulders at it. We'll get back to that, but we want to. I want to dive more deeply into some of the things that we have learned about this administration. You know that we are. I think we share the same DNA with Republican voters against Trump, and I think probably one of their most viewed videos featured a young man named Miles Taylor, a longtime, lifelong Republican, former top official in the Department of Homeland Security. And this is what he had to say.
I served as the chief of staff of the Department of Homeland Security under the Donald Trump administration. And it was my job to help the Department of Homeland Security to keep our country safe. What we saw was terrifying. The president wanted to exploit the Department of Homeland Security for his own political purposes and to fuel his own agenda. The California wildfires. He told us to stop giving money to people whose houses had burned down because politically it wasn't a base for him. Month after month, he said he wanted to have a deliberate policy of ripping children away from their parents to show those parents that they shouldn't come to the border in the first place. A cyber attack, a terrorism threat. He wasn't interested in those things. He was one of the most unfocused, undisciplined senior executives I've ever encountered. And even though I'm not a Democrat, even though I disagree on key issues, I have to support Joe Biden for president. And I'm confident he won't make the same mistakes as this president.
Defending Democracy Together is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Miles Taylor joins us on this morning's podcast. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate it very much.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
Okay, so let's just start with this, and I want to get into the allegations. And I have to say, I think the allegation about the withholding funds from California during the wildfires is one of the most revealing moments in this presidency. But there are so many that you've talked about. But you know, there's obvious questions about this, Miles, including why did you join the Trump administration in the first place?
Yeah, it's a great question. In fact, if I was on the other end of this conversation as one of your listeners, I would be doubtful about the credibility of the person speaking about their time in the administration. And for this reason, because no one should have been under any illusion about who Donald Trump was when he came into the White House, right? We've all seen the supercut of Nikki Haley, Lindsey Graham, on and on down the list of people who are now Trump supporters during the campaign, delineating his faults and excoriating him for not being a Republican, and of course, much worse, assailing his fundamental character. So it was evident who Donald Trump was. But in my case, and one of the reasons that I didn't sign the letter in 2016 of a number of former national security officials who were opposed to him, is in my thinking, we had to give him a shot. We had to see if he could succeed. I mean, I'm a lifelong Republican. Despite not, admiring Donald Trump's character at the time, I thought, look, we have a shot here to do some really good things. And if you look at any recent president, I think all of them have said that the job changed them and that being in the Oval Office was sobering. And if anything, you can see it in their hair, right? They all go gray quickly. And mm-hmm. I think there was a hope, now I would say a very foolish hope, that the job would sober him a bit, he'd get off Twitter, he'd get in the game, and we could do some big things. And look, all of us, I think, feel like there's a version of Donald Trump, if you removed all that bad stuff, where you could say, I don't know, kind of the brash, you know, say it like it is politician could be something that we need right now. I mean, there was a version of him that I think people would have welcomed and could have been a good president. We never saw that.
So did you vote for him?
Well, not only that, I mean, I helped on the campaign. Now, I wasn't an official campaign aide, but Michael McCaul, who was then chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee, he and I jumped in to help Trump's national security team during the campaign. And here's why. I mean, here's the day that we did it, is Donald Trump said Muslim ban. And McCaul and I sat down and had a conversation. And I said, look, we cannot let the standard bearer of our party say things like that. It's un-American, it's inappropriate, it's disgusting. And whether he wins or loses, this is going to sink us if we talk like this. So let's get involved. Let's help his team, which was really thin at the time. Let's help them craft a more credible vision for U.S. national security at home and abroad. So we did that. We helped them out. He actually never said, to my knowledge, Muslim ban again after we walked him through, you know, this is why this is a particularly insane way to portray what you want to do on counterterrorism. And so in a way, again, foolishly, I thought, wow, that's a victory, right? We got him to change. We got him to realize that what he'd said was inappropriate and disgusting and not a way to think about counterterrorism. But of course, you know, those hopes that he might be able to change were dashed through hard experience being in the administration. But look, I think we all deserved to give the president a shot, whether you voted for him or not, even people who were the staunchest Hillary supporters. Look, this man became president of the United States. Got to stand behind him and root for him to succeed. And so a lot of us went in with that hope. Let's try to make this work. And seeing him up close and personal was enough to convince me, at least, that he was never going to change. And in fact, he probably doubled down on his worst impulses on a weekly basis.
Well, speaking of the worst impulses, that moment where he called for the complete ban for Muslims was the breaking point for a lot of Republicans who said that, you know, this is completely not acceptable. So you basically, you saw that dumpster fire and you went toward it. So that was the moment that you engaged with Donald Trump.
Yeah. You know, I think that people had to do it. There are two types.
Well, they didn't have to do it.
Yeah, well, there are two types of people in Donald Trump's orbit. There are arsonists and there are firefighters. And the arsonists see the Donald Trump dumpster fire and they run towards it with gasoline. And they are his sycophants and they are the people who love the hateful rhetoric and want to feed it. There are, or at least for a time, there were a lot of firefighters in Donald Trump's orbit that he brought into the administration that saw those fires and said, this is bad for the country. This is bad for the party. This is bad for you, Mr. President. This is bad for Americans. You know, we got to put some of these fires out. What we've seen happen is Trump has systematically assassinated the firefighters and he's surrounded himself with the arsonists. And that dumpster fire is now, you know, a 5-alarm fire encompassing an entire city block that is America. So without stretching the metaphor too far, I don't think we're going to be able to put this blaze out. And that's why voters have got to bring someone else in. It's the only option. And I've said this before, as we're mixing metaphors, you know, right now the Republican Party is on life support. If Donald Trump wins re-election, it's going to go straight to hospice care. And that's it. And we're in the final days of the party. So for Republicans that are listening, I mean, I think that that's one reason why we've got to do it. This is literally life or death for the Republican Party.
Okay, I'm going to get to that in a moment. And I just want to go back to this. So you came in somewhat hopeful that maybe, in fact, you could be one of the adults in the room and restrain him. And there were a lot of folks who did that, including, you know, H.R. McMaster and James Mattis. And I think, you know, looking back, we ought to be grateful that some of them probably did stop some of the worst things. But you know, as you've recounted very graphically, though, once you get into office, you begin to see who Donald Trump was, and you began to see that the optimistic picture was not true. Why did you stay as long as you did? Because it must have been apparent to you relatively early on, and you recount some of these stories. So why did you stay when, in fact, you were part of the department that was separating children from the border? So I'm going to get to this. I mean, I understand the decision you made. I'm not trying to beat up on you. I'm just trying to have people understand what it must have been like being there, making that decision. Do I stay or do I go? How long was that period?
No. It's an important question. And I welcome the scrutiny because we need to be asking this question of people. If we're ever going to stop this from happening again, there needs to be some real soul searching.
Yeah,
that happens among people who are in this administration, among virtually every major Republican official who has, you know, either silently or actively supported what the president is doing. So again, that soul searching needs to happen, and everyone needs to be on the receiving end of some tough questioning. In my case, I genuinely believe I should have left a year earlier in 2018, but no earlier than that. And here's why: because in year one, I think we really did believe that on balance, we were preventing more bad things from happening than letting things, slip past the goalie that the president wanted to do that we thought were bad or we advised against. I think that calculus was true in year one. There were some truly insane things that the president wanted to make happen. And some of them have been out in the public domain, some haven't, and some will remain classified for many years. And hopefully other folks that were in that so-called axis of adults will tell the stories that they can tell. But in year one, you would get phone calls from, HR McMaster, whoever it might be. Hey, the president right now is getting ready to pull out of X extremely important treaty or negotiation or country or do something with the troops that's inappropriate. Drop everything. Everyone cancel your schedules. Get to the bleeping White House, like this thing burning down. And so this would happen all the time. Fortunately, those were often stopped and the public didn't hear about them. And that was good. And there was a false sort of sense of comfort inside the cabinet of, well, this is bad, but we're keeping him from doing some of these really reckless things.
We can contain it.
Yeah. We can contain the fire. We get into year two, and that logic started to fray, and then it became evident that our supposition was completely wrong. And that's when Donald Trump began his systematic elimination of some of those key guardrails around him, firing Gary Cohen, and then, pushing Mattis out the door, pushing my former boss, John Kelly, out the door. Dan Coats' head was on the chopping block at the time. Kirstjen Nielsen had been signaled to the president that she was going to go. I mean, it was clear he was going to start pushing all these people out. He fired Rex Tillerson. So of course, HR left. So this is all starting to happen in year two and going into year three. I think that's the point at which there was the inflection of we're doing more good than the harm that we're able to prevent. And that's probably why I should have left in 2018. Stayed into 2019, though, because there was a big fear, especially in our department, because it was the most central department to the president's vision and mission, that if we left, we knew the Trump lackeys that he wanted to install into the job. At the time, I'm happy to say, he was adamant that Kris Kobach become Secretary of Homeland Security. The plan was to fire Kirstjen and to put Kris Kobach in. And we all knew that that would be terrifying. He would be the ultimate enabler of Donald Trump's anti-immigrant agenda and would have no interest whatsoever in the myriad of other missions that DHS is engaged in to protect Americans, cyber threats, terrorists, foreign interference. So we hung on because we were worried about that alternative. But I still think that that meant that we ended up failing to stop other things that I wish we had. So there's a little bit of regret there on my end. And ultimately, it became clear to me that we weren't going to be able to do much more good. And so I left. And the president was going to do whatever he wanted. He was going to fire whoever he needed to make sure that he installed sycophants into those jobs.
I'm really curious to hear your take on this. Obviously, you worked very, very closely with Kirstjen Nielsen, who is regarded on the left very much as a villain. But I'm guessing from your account that she was one of those who pushed back against some of this. So give me your take on her role in all of this.
Yeah. Well, the secretary's not going to love me saying this, but I'll say it. There's an interesting public perception of her tenure. And like you said, the left really despises her and ties her to family separation. And I think unfairly, and that's because the secretary left and didn't try to go on a reputation tour write a multi-million-dollar book to save herself or anything. But that's meant that public perception has remained in people's minds. When in reality, as someone who was there every day, probably she was the most aggressive in speaking truth to power behind the scenes to the president of anyone. Short of a handful of other folks, and I won't try to bring other people into this, but there was a couple other cabinet members who, when the president would suggest something that, if not illegal, was maybe wildly inappropriate or impossible, they would speak up and say, "Mr. President, we can't do that." Most folks, though, especially in year three, would sit there silently and accept whatever the president said. I mean, it was pretty disgusting to see sometimes. So she was very honest with the president. But then look, when he made a decision, ultimately, she'd go out there and support it. I think that on family separation, the story is starting to come out now. And I'm not trying to toot my horn. I mean, part of it is because some of us who were there are starting to speak about it. And not to bolster the secretary's image, but to say, actually, guys, what was happening behind the scenes is the attorney general and the White House were in cahoots to launch the zero tolerance policy at the border. DHS got outvoted. And behind the scenes, we said, look, we don't think we can do this. We don't think we can refer all these people to you for prosecution because there's not the resources to do it quickly enough without this turning into a disaster and a backlog. Because look, it happens every day. Newsflash to Americans, family separation is happening now, and it happened during the Obama administration, because all it means is when someone gets prosecuted at the border, they've got to go to jail for a little bit until the case is heard. And you can't bring a child into a jail. That's disgusting. You wouldn't do it. So for a brief period of time, they have to be in government custody. Well, if you go from prosecuting, I don't know, let's say a couple dozen a day to thousands a day, all of a sudden, those kids aren't being reunited in 24 hours. Those kids are spending days, if not weeks away. And that's what the secretary behind the scenes said. She said, this is going to happen if you guys don't give me the resources. However, the Justice Department, the White House at the time said, you don't know what you're talking about, Secretary. We've got all the judges and lawyers we need to process these quickly. And then our own agencies, and I won't name names, but the heads of our own agencies in DHS came to the secretary, and these are people who are big, you know, friends with politicals at the White House, said, don't worry, you're overreacting. We have everything we need to have this happen quickly. Mm-hmm. There won't be a problem. They were wrong. She was right. And it took a few weeks lag time to see that play out. But once it did, behind the scenes, the secretary was saying, this is a disaster. I was right. These people who outvoted me in the cabinet to say we had to go forward were wrong. We've got to get the president to sign an executive order to put an end to this. Unfortunately, we did. Now, here's the scarier thing, Charlie, is, as I've said publicly, the rest of the administration, almost every month, the president would say to us, we got to go back to family separation. But in his mind, it was a deliberate policy of just rip every kid from every parent and keep the kid away from
it. It was a deliberate. So for him, the cruelty was the point, right? It was, you did this.
The cruelty was the point. Yes. For the president, the cruelty was the point. For the attorney general, they wanted to prosecute as many illegal crossers as possible. I don't believe Jeff Sessions at the time had the intent of indefinitely separating children from families. It was a horrible secondary consequence, but one that was foreseeable because the Trump administration policy process was so damn broken that no consideration was given to these urgent red flags that we saw. And look, that's one more reason why the man shouldn't be reelected president.
Yeah.
This process of interagency decision-making is just totally destroyed and broken.
But shouldn't the secretary, at the point that she was outvoted by the cabinet and was told to do something that she thought was wrong, isn't that the moment when she ought to have resigned? Isn't that the moment when people have to make the decision? Do you stay and do you implement something that you fundamentally think is wrong? Yeah.
Well, look, that's why I say 2018 might have been the more appropriate time, at least for me to exit. I won't comment on, the secretary's tenure, but I will say this. She was a very, very vocal proponent in correcting some of these errors behind the scenes. But there was a lot of other things at play at that time. As you remember, we're in the middle of the Mueller investigation, and there were some darker things that we were worried if he installed a yes man into the Homeland Security job, we'd end up with worse outcomes. But it's a very fair question to ask of her, of me, and of other people, because we've got to look back at that and assess it with clear eyes.
All right, let's talk about some of the things that you have talked about, because there's so many things that we could focus on. Promising pardons for officials who broke the law. Chief of Staff, Sean Hannity being the shadow chief of staff, all of these things, the president.
Lou Dobbs.
Okay. So, but here's the one that really, and I wrote about it in my newsletter today. Yeah. Your the story about the California wildfires that the president actually was talking about withholding aid from people who'd lost their homes because California was not politically supportive of him. And this vision of America divided into red and blue, that the way you have characterized him, this is a president who does not see us as American citizens, but simply as pawns evaluated by our political usefulness. So you live in a blue state and basically screw you.
Yeah. And I've got to say, this isn't hyperbole when I tell these stories. I mean, the president would make direct connection between the political aspect and support for Americans trying to recover from devastating disasters. So in California, in that instance, I haven't said this publicly yet, but in California, when we were having some of those conversations about the wildfire money, he would go on these harangues about how Jerry Brown had been a terrible governor, and you know Gavin Newsom had relatively recently come in. And I remember one of the phone calls with him, and he said, "You know, damn it, have you seen you know Gavin Newsom's speech?" I think it was maybe you know his whatever his big you know State of California address was. He said, "Have you seen his speech? You know, he's totally against me. He's totally against the administration. You know, we can't have this." And then in the next breath, basically said, cut off the money for the wildfires, right? I mean, the implication was clear. Gavin Newsom doesn't like me, doesn't support me, is against my agenda, so let's not give money to the people in his state whose homes are burning to the ground. I mean, our jaws hit the floor when that happened. And of course, we weren't going to allow that to go forward. And, you know, we pushed back on the president and, you know, said that that's not something we can do. Individual assistance is to help these people recover. But that wasn't the only incident. Charlie, we had the same thing happen with Puerto Rico, is especially as soon as, you know, folks on the island, politicians on the island were going on TV and criticizing the administration for the lackluster response. That drove Donald Trump to basically say behind the scenes, well, cut the money off. They don't deserve it. They got themselves into this mess in the first place. We don't need to pay to clean up their mess. These are Americans. These are Americans that that he's the president for. And because politicians down there were criticizing him, he didn't want to help them rebuild. And that, by the way, was a consistent feature all throughout the very long-term recovery in Puerto Rico. Trump regularly chafed at anything that had to do with recovery. In fact, so much so to the point that people were scared to give the White House numbers about grant money and assistance that was going to Puerto Rico. We were scared for the president to see the numbers because the damage was a lot. The numbers were big in the billions, but the worry was he would see them and again say, don't give them any of that money.
You know, the extraordinary thing about your account is that we suspected all of this was going on, but you provide these sort of graphic details of what's happening behind the scenes, including his chronic, I don't know how else to describe it, his chronic contempt for the law. And you've described the many times when, you know, he wanted to do things that were illegal, it was pointed out he was illegal. And the rather extraordinary story you tell about him promising pardons to people, basically knowing that he was asking them to do things that violated the law and telling them that he would provide, he would abuse his pardon power to let them get away with it.
Yeah, that was really the moment that I grabbed my time card and I punched out forever. That was the proximate cause to me leaving is after we had that episode down at the border, we were on the flight back and I was texting someone who I won't name back at the White House, a senior official, and relayed the story and said, I gotta go. I'm going soon enough. And the only reason I didn't leave that day that he said that is because very shortly thereafter, it became clear that he was going to try to push Secretary Nielsen out. I had a real worry that they were going to purge all of us at the time, and the department would go into free fall. I mean, again, keep in mind, DHS does a lot more than border and immigration. We protect Americans against a lot of threats. It was a department that, of course, was built out of the rubble of 9/11. So, and there were senior advisors in the White House that were literally signaling there's going to be a full purge. And so I hunkered down and said, we got to try to save as many of these people as possible. Otherwise, this department's going to spiral. And the second and third order consequences will affect so many other security issues that Americans depend on their government for. What did they do? They did a purge. Kirstjen Nielsen was pushed out. The deputy secretary was pushed out. The chief lawyer of the department was pushed out. A number of other individuals were moved to different jobs or fired from the administration. Incredibly, they avoided kicking me out at that point in time. And they temporarily installed Kevin McAleen in as the acting secretary. So I said to Kevin, I'm going to hang here for a few months to help you steady this ship, but then I'm out of here. And so we did that, and I took off. But then, of course, you know, after not long, Kevin was pushed out as well, and a number of other senior officials were fired. So that's what the president does. I mean, he continues to dangle people's jobs over their heads to get them to do what he wants them to do. And if they don't, he kicks them out of the administration because he does not like to hear the truth. I want to say one more thing on the illegality piece. I mean, nowhere was this more evident than the way he talked about migrants. The president of the United States deliberately told us on multiple occasions to implement policies that would maim, tear gas, and injure innocent, unarmed civilians coming towards the United States border. Clearly, we didn't do those things as policies, but that sort of sickening approach, the very visceral, I want to hurt these people to deter them, was his mindset, the maiming. That's why he kept telling us to sharpen the spikes on top of the wall, as he said he wanted it to be able to go through their hands and their arms and pierce human flesh. I mean, that's how he described it to us.
He says this. This is the way he talks. You have the president who seems to have a passion for committing atrocities.
He was so sickly, folks. I want to go back to the spikes because
he
pressed us for a cost estimate. He said, look, I think these bollards, right? Steel bollards, imagine them like flagpoles lined up against each other across the border. These steel bollards that are, sharp at the top, but in some cases rounded. The president said, I want you to do a cost estimate. How can you make those as sharp as possible across the border? What's it going to cost us? And then he described it. He described what he wanted the spikes to be able to do to one of those migrants who tried to climb over. Now, look, I'm a national security conservative. Border security is important, but I don't have sick bloodlust for innocent people fleeing violence and persecution trying to come to America. In fact, we're supposed to be the shining city on a hill, not the city that puts spikes in the arms of migrants who are trying to flee for their safety. So there was that. And then here's another one, Charlie, is there was an incident at the border when a caravan was coming in, and there were some individuals in the caravan that started to attack a Border Patrol station. They were throwing rocks and trying to get in. And at that local station, it's protocol to do crowd control. And they issued some tear gas canisters to try to disperse the crowd so that people wouldn't get injured. Officers wouldn't get attacked, sort of standard procedure. We didn't know about this until after the fact, of course. The president sees it on Fox News and calls us up and says, oh my God, what you're doing, gassing migrants at the border, like, keep it up. You look so, so tough. And the secretary and I were stunned because in the president's mind, he thought we were now implementing a policy of just gassing migrants to deter them rather than recognizing this was an isolated incident. And then not long after that, he went on TV and he said, despite us telling him he absolutely shouldn't, if they throw rocks, we will use rifles.
I remember that. Yeah. Yeah. And, but Donald Trump had told us who he was back in 2016. Remember during the campaign, he actually talked about how we might commit war crimes. And people would say, well, would the military do that? And he said, well, if I tell them to do it, they will do it. Kill the families of terrorists. He used to, tell this fake story about General Pershing in before World War One, lining up Muslims and shooting them with bullets dipped in pig blood and things like that. So this penchant for war crimes, atrocities, cruelty, it couldn't have come as a surprise to you. Was the surprise that here's the president of the United States asking? In your mind, were you thinking, oh, he's just blustering? This is just him talking. We can't take him seriously or literally. And then suddenly you're there in the room, and there's the president who's saying, I really want to do this stuff.
Well, look, people can scoff at it, but those moments were the moments that validated this is why the hell we actually do need to be here. You look at the people who were on the campaign, it was an island of misfit toys that Trump had around him that he was going to bring into the administration. I could not be more grateful as a citizen and taxpayer than the fact that the John Kellys and the Rex Tillersons and the H.R. McMasters did come in. Ultimately, were we wrong about our ability to restrain Donald Trump's worst impulses? Yes, we were ultimately wrong about that. But I absolutely don't regret that people went in and tried to do that, because in those moments you would say, dear God, would another person look at him and say, yeah, we'll do that?
Well, this is what's so compelling about this at the moment, because as you said earlier, all of those guys are gone. They've assassinated all of those firefighters. So it immediately brings to mind, if guys like you and H.R. McMaster and Tillerson are not in the room, what would a second term be like? I know you've thought about this. A Donald Trump with, safely reelected, another 4 years in office, none of these responsible adults around, what would that be like?
Well, I think we saw it this week with the Republican National Convention. It will be rather than a willingness to embrace the rule of law, it will be a full-on hug of illegality and corruption. And we saw that with the president abusing his office, his powers, and federal property to facilitate his reelection. And that's, I think, no more fitting image could have been had than that for the president to signal what a second term would look like. And I think with the guardrails gone, Trump will really feel uninhibited and willing to do all those things that I said we played whack-a-mole with to prevent. He's going to light it up, and he's going to try to do all of that. We are also going to see him, especially in foreign and defense policy, take actions that will quite literally and directly put Americans in danger. He will pull out of pacts that we have with fellow nation states. I suspect he will pull out of NATO. I think he will remove U.S. troops from places where they are central to playing offense so that we don't have to play defense here in the homeland. He will make a lot of really bad decisions on the foreign and defense policy front. Here on the home front, I think the president wants to assert executive authority throughout American communities. I mean, you see that with his response to protests nationwide. He is itching to use the powers of the federal government to be more directly involved in the lives of Americans at a state and local level. I can't imagine anything less conservative than that in terms of policy principles. He wants a strong executive. He wants to control the lives of Americans. And I think you're going to see his autocratic impulses on steroids in a second term. That's the piece to worry about. And there won't be people to try to give the checks and balances when and if that happens.
And every time he gets away with it, I think it also then emboldens him. And, you know, let's talk about the fact that he announced, I'm going to have the Republican convention speech at the White House. And people said, well, you can't do that. I mean, that would be just, you know, horrible to turn the White House into a prop. It would violate the Hatch Act. And he basically said, I don't care what you think about it. And he did it. He pulled it off. And as of right now, there are no consequences for it. So he's got to be looking at, you know, looking around at his buddies and going, hey, you know what? I can pardon my friends. I can pardon anyone I want. I can I can ignore the Hatch Act. I can use every lever of power. And who's going to stop me? And so each time he does it, I think it leads to the next one, as you point out, and there's no one there to stop. There's an interesting debate, Miles, and I want to get your sense of this, and I go back and forth on this, the whole question of the Hatch Act, where I think the cool kids in Washington media have decided nobody cares about this. People in Wisconsin don't care about the Hatch Act. This is not anything that's going to, you know, quote unquote, move the needle. On the other hand, that's never been the standard for whether we follow laws or not, right? You know, whether or not, you know, it polls well. So we have this violation of the law. Part of me says this is a very big deal and we ought to treat it like it's a very big deal, even knowing that maybe the, you know, American public has gotten so numb to this that they shrug their shoulders. But it feels like a scary moment for just sort of the collapse of all the guardrails as you've described them.
Yeah, I think that that's absolutely right. I mean, this is where we get to the issue of norms. Is I think as the president makes illegality seem routine, people start to lose respect for the rule of law and are sort of ambivalent about it. I mean, this is quite literally how countries fall apart. And this is how civilizations decline, is this type of leader, this type of demagoguery leads to disrespect for foundational norms that created the unifying principles that undergird the republic in the first place. And that sounds hyperbolic to some people. It's literally what we're living through. I mean, a great example would be during impeachment. Most Americans don't care about the Impoundment Control Act and did Congress appropriate money for this country or that country. Who cares? If the president wants to cut off money to a country, he can cut off money to a country. That's what a lot of half the country felt that way after the Ukraine scandal. Half the country felt like, well, it's fine for the president to be able to do this. No, it's blatantly illegal for him to cut off the funds that Congress had appropriated. But setting that precedent, especially the fact that he wasn't removed from office for it, is going to allow him in a second term to say, I can do that again, and much worse.
So, Miles Taylor, what happens if he loses? There's a lot of speculation about what will happen if the election is close or it is disputed. What do you think happens? How does Donald Trump react to defeat?
Yeah, I hate to engage in the speculation because I think what Donald Trump speculates about dangerous things, he sort of wills them into reality. But in this case, I think there's reason to be very alarmed. If past is prologue, Donald Trump will not accept losing with his head held high. He does not accept defeat. He wants to be a winner. The only way Donald Trump can lose the election and in his own mind still emerge as a winner is if he makes millions of people think he actually won. I can't emphasize that enough. If he loses, Donald Trump will, and mark my words, we'll go back to this tape, he will try to find a way to portray that he actually did win and that the loss was illegitimate, so the rest of his life he can say, I never lost, I really still should be your president. How will he do that is the open question, but any way he does it is enough to further erode our democratic process and our confidence in government. He may do that by actively deploying lawyers all around the country to challenge the results in various states. He may do that by refusing to accept the results. He may do that in the most extreme example, by refusing to leave office and proposing perhaps a different day for the inauguration, despite the fact that it's constitutionally stipulated. You can see the president doing any number of things to try to challenge the outcome if he loses. Ultimately, will the president leave? Yes. I don't actually fear that Donald Trump is going to hole up for the second time down in his bunker to try to stay in the White House. But I do fear that that whole process of trying to portray the election as illegitimate and he is the rightful second-term president will erode Americans' faith in democracy. And what's worse, Charlie, I think it's very likely that it'll spark widespread nationwide civil unrest if that's how it plays out. So what we need is other politicians in the United States, especially in the president's own party, to really push back hard against him if something like this happens. And hopefully the courts are ready to step up if we get into ugly territory.
Yeah, that may be the final off-ramp for a lot of Republicans, whether or not other Republicans will say, okay, we were with you up until now, but you cannot do this, whether they will do this. I just want to emphasize here that a lot of pundits have speculated about the way the president is going to react and what he will do. But Miles Taylor was in the room, has watched the president, has listened to the president, has seen how the president reacts and how his mind works and how he makes decisions. And that's what makes this so troubling. Okay, so Miles, tell me what happens next. You have formed an organization, is that correct, called Repair. You're not alone, because this is a big question. You know, will other people speak out? And so tell me what happens next. You've said that you're not alone. There's a bunch of people who share your concerns, and we're going to be hearing from them between now and November 3rd.
Well, I hope we do. So our organization is the Republican Political Alliance for Integrity and Reform. The acronym is REPAIR for a reason. Our focus is twofold: repair the party and repair the country in the wake of Donald Trump. We do have a good team right now. It's a core team of ex-Trump officials that are organizing it. We will bring in a number of other folks from the party, people who didn't serve in the Trump administration, but served in previous Republican administrations, to join us. And our focus is a little bit different than the other folks you see out there, like Lincoln Project and Republican Voters Against Trump, in that they are looking at the 10-meter target of defeating Donald Trump on November 3rd.
Right.
We're, of course, supportive of that mission, but we really want to focus on how do we remake the party to get past this. There's going to have to be something like a Truth and Reconciliation Commission within the Republican Party after Donald Trump leaves, because most of our major politicians, who aren't going to be replaced anytime soon on the GOP side, supported the president. So they're going to have to come to a place where they explain why, atone for that, but also embrace more inclusive and smarter GOP policies going forward. So we want to contribute to that effort. What I will say is this: we've had a lot of conversations with people who've left the administration, people who are currently in the administration. There are some people who are current senior officials who may be joining us in this effort. We'll have more to say on that after Labor Day. But, you know, there's a lot of folks that are afraid, Charlie. President has made folks fear for their jobs, their families, their futures, and in some cases, their lives if they speak out. I've said this publicly because I think it's really important for people to know. Not because I want sympathy, but, you know, my wife and I have already been on the receiving end of pretty spooky and graphic death threats. That's because of the rhetoric that the president has put out there. They use these dog whistles to say, for instance, with the intelligence community whistleblower, that he's a traitor and we used to hang traitors. Mm-hmm. Wink, nod. He's making a suggestion. Go harm that person. That's what they do. So, I've talked to names that you all would know very, very well behind the scenes and said, I want you to come join the team. There's a lot of folks that are really scared. They're on the fence. They feel the same way. In fact, I'm going to tell you this, the vast majority, upwards of 90% of senior former officials that have left this administration that I've spoken to, both while I was on the job and afterwards, get it. They see what's going on. They're clear-eyed about the president's faults. I mean, they really, really do get it. But I'd say most of them are scared. They're really scared to come out. And I don't blame them. It's not an easy thing to do, but it's absolutely the right thing. And my message to them would be this. Despite the costs, financially, personally, and otherwise, the weight that you feel lifted is going to outweigh that cost by orders of magnitude, because you get your conscience back. And you can't buy that, and you can't put a price tag on that. So I think that we have some folks that are willing to do the same. We'll see, but it makes it a little bit easier once others get out there and take some of the incoming fire for the reinforcements to come in. I hope we see that. I can't give you, you know, full assurances that you're going to see an army of ex-Trump officials, but there is an army right now of silent ex-Trump officials that all feel the same way about this. They're the household names that you know, and I hope some of them put country over party and speak up.
What do you think happens to you, though? Do you think that you will have a place in the Republican Party after Trump, given everything that's happened?
Well, look, you know, I'd said this before publicly, a lot of people have sent me, you know, nasty Twitter messages and other things to say, you know, your career in the GOP is finished, man. And my response has been, if the GOP remains the party of Trump, there's not going to be any farewell kisses. Okay. I'm not going to have any love loss about that. Now, I'll still try over the next 4 years, if there's a second Trump term, to make sure that after he's in office, that we get the party back on track. Repair will still function. This organization, we will go forward. We will try to plot what the post-Trump America looks like. But I went into this fully recognizing that the party and the ideology in which I built my life around, I might be persona non grata. I might be PNG'd from that organization. And you know what? I'm perfectly comfortable with that. I have no regrets whatsoever, because at the end of the day, character is going to be what matters, not just in this election, but for each of us in our lives afterwards. This isn't about Donald Trump, really, at the end of the day. It's what we've let Trump do to each of us, whether it's people who've served in his administration, but more importantly, the millions of Americans who are scared to call a brother or sister, talk to a neighbor because of an intense political animus. That's what we've got to focus on. We've really got to go back to the neighborhood and household level with each other and say, how do we feel about this? Is this who we really want to be? And I think that's what the referendum is on November 3rd. The referendum isn't really about Donald Trump. The referendum is, who do we want to be as Americans?
Miles Taylor, thank you so much for joining us on the Bulwark Podcast. Appreciate it very, very much.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back on Monday, and we will do this all over again. As of Friday, there are 66 days to go until the election.